Hi, this is Paul, and I've been looking forward to this conversation for a while. Actually, John invited me a while ago, and I kind of put him off because I wanted to hear a lot more of his course before we had this conversation. So, John, I really appreciate you coming on and having this conversation today.
Oh, well, Paul, I mean, it's been great watching your work and your commentary on my work, and other people via you commenting on my work, and it's just a great pleasure to be here. Thank you very much.
Well, I thought we might begin because with a little bit more autobiographical stuff from you. I've listened to a lot of you, and as a pastor, a lot of what I spend time doing with people is hearing their stories. So I was just a little bit curious about, you know, Vervaeke. That sounded Dutch to me. I don't know if it is or isn't.
It's Flemish. It's Flemish.
Flemish.
With an anglicized pronunciation, yeah.
Okay. So tell me a little bit about where you were from, how you were raised, some of those kind of things.
Okay. I'm usually reticent on this, but I can understand why you want to know those kinds of things. I was raised in Dundas, Ontario, in Canada, which is a little town on the hub of Hamilton and Burlington. I don't know if that means anything, but it's in the Golden Horseshoe, right, area. And I was raised in a fundamentalist Christian family. Extended family was fundamentalist Christian, very much a literalist, very literalist, an inerrancy view of the Bible, a hostile view to almost all other denominations, let alone other religions, that sort of thing. And then when I was around 15 or 16, I read a book. It was a science fiction book by Roger Zelazny called Lord of Light. It's a great science fiction book. He won the Hugo Award. He was nominated for the Nebula. But what happened is I was introduced to Hindu mythology and Buddhism. And it was just like, whoa. And this was like a startling eye-opener to me. And then very shortly thereafter, I started reading some Hermann Hesse and Robertson Davies, got introduced to Jung. Got introduced a little bit more to both Jung, because Hesse is kind of an integration of Jung and some Buddhism and some Vedanta. And then I very quickly became very critical of the Christianity I've been brought up in. I sort of consider myself an atheist. And I was quite angry. I was quite almost hostile because I felt abused by that upbringing in a lot of ways. So the contrast was very super salient to me, and that caused a very negative reaction. Then I got into university very shortly thereafter, and I encountered Plato. So Jung was my first your first psychologist and your first philosophers are like your first girlfriend, right? They're like deeply informative. I have finger puppets on my fridge. One is of Jung and the other is of Plato. Just to signify that, right? So I got introduced to Plato and then a figure that who has continued to play just a lasting and profound effect on my life, the figure of Socrates. And for me, this was an alternative path. And the cultivation of wisdom came to me as, okay, this deepens and makes more coherent and gives me a path that I was sort of getting glimpses of in these other books that have sort of opened my eyes. So I started pursuing academic philosophy in a very deep way. But much to my disappointment, the topic of wisdom and self-transcendence and the kind of stuff that's central in Plato and the connection between love and reason, that quickly fell away. Now, I had come to see the independent value of academic philosophy, you know, the reflections on science, reflections on culture, the reflections on ethics and knowledge. So I saw that as independently valuable, and the skills were valuable, the cultivation of rationality and reflection. But that hunger for the cultivation of wisdom was not abated in any way, didn't go away. If anything, it intensified. So I found a place in which they were teaching in a conjoined fashion Tai Chi Chuan, Vipassana meditation, and Metta contemplation, as I talk about an ecology of practices that have a complementary relationship to each other. And this impacted on me very deeply. But along the same time, late 80s, early 90s, I also, I've been reading a lot of Heidegger, I was deeply affected by Heidegger, but I also had some very significant criticisms of it. And I got into the work of Tillich, and Tillich had sort of and especially his discussions of the role of symbol, the correlational method. You can see that influence in even my current work. That's so profound. And that sort of led me back to trying Christianity again. So I went back into Christianity again, a much more liberal version of it. I got sort of deeply involved, moved to an even more liberal version from the one I originally went into. But I kept discovering that I was trying to shoehorn the things I was learning in my practice into Christianity, and it was progressively not fitting. And also I was noticing that the stuff I loved in Christianity was pretty much the Neoplatonic aspects of it. And so I decided I'm just going to stop trying to shoehorn. I'm just going to pursue the Neoplatonism, which I continue to do. Plotinus is a huge influence on me. But Christian Platonists like Augustine. And then I also continued on with the Tai Chi and the meditative and contemplative practices. And I started adding other practices along the way. And then, it was sort of a personal kairos for me, because as I got deeper into this, personally, the disciplines, both philosophy and psychology, had come back around. So mindfulness, I was one of the first people to talk about mindfulness academically at the University of Toronto. And so mindfulness and wisdom and even, aspects of mystical experience, all of these started to come back around and be considered respectable. And so all of a sudden, I was actually well disposed to pursuing this scientifically. And so I started doing that. I started to teach about these topics within a scientific, academic, and philosophical context. But of course, I also started teaching. I'd already been teaching and continued to teach the Tai Chi and the meditation extracurricular. And then I started doing that we have a center at the University of Toronto called the Multi-Faith Center. And I started teaching there. And so I kept that up. And then more and more, I was seeing how many people were affected by these issues I was talking about, how hungry they were to talk about meaning in life, self-transcendence, wisdom, and also related, ideas like foolishness, self-deception. And then I started, Evan Thompson was going to teach a course called Buddhism and Kogsai, and then he sort of couldn't do it. And then he said, well, John would be a good person to teach it. So he recommended me, and I started teaching that course, and then that evolved. And all of what happened is all the other work I've been doing sort of constellated into this argument about, and it's been evolving, about trying to figure out, first of all, articulate and express what I was seeing, right, in more general, the meaning crisis historically, and then connect that with the cognitive scientific work of trying to understand these things, meaning cultivation, self-transcendence, wisdom, higher states of consciousness. And then that I recorded, as you rightly commented many times, a very poorly recorded, very low production value version of Buddhism and Kogsai. And then, of course, I continued to teach it. And there's new material, which I think you've seen throughout the series, and there'll be even more new material at the end. And one of my students, former students, came to me and he said, you got to do a way better job because this is important. And his father was a professional editor. And then they came to me and they said, let's do this. Let's do this series. And I said, are you really? Because if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do like 50 episodes because this is a long argument. And they said, no, we're in for it. And so that's how the series came together. And then, I've been doing, and then I upload talks and things like that. Yeah. Just so your viewers know, I'm an assistant professor, hopefully soon associate, very close, at the University of Toronto. And I'm 60% in cognitive psychology and 40% in cognitive science. So that's sort of my story.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. And that's very helpful because I see with people their passion, so often their effectiveness in a field is connected with their story.
Oh yeah.
People get into things that they get into for their reasons, and so it's helpful for me to understand a little bit more of the story. And so it was actually I know it's a guy who's contacted you, a guy who lives in South Africa who first put me on to your Buddhism and cognitive science. He just kept sending me emails saying, oh, you got to watch this stuff. You got to watch this stuff. And I get a lot of emails from people. It's like, oh, okay. And, and then when you started the Awakening from the Meaning Crisis, I really caught on to that. And I have learned so much from that course already. I found so much of it applicable to, so my grandfather lived for a while in Ontario. He went up and took a church in Owen Sound, Ontario, I eventually met someone from Owen Sound. He said, yeah, well, here's the elephant. Owen Sound is right under the tail. And so that was in the 50s when Dutch immigrants were leaving war-torn Netherlands, going to Owen Sound. And, you know, the stories, my grandfather very much felt a call to go there. It was part of, you know, so often you feel a call to go to the place you least want to go. And his wife, my grandmother, did not want to go there. My father was just finishing high school, so he actually never moved there. He kept going on to college then in Grand Rapids, Michigan, to Calvin College, where our family has gone to school. But the stories that I would hear from my grandmother of their time there, she really didn't like it. But listening far later, you just had the sense that these Dutch and Frisian people were coming from the Netherlands. They had just been utterly traumatized by the war.
Of course, yeah.
And so when they got there, they weren't getting along with each other. The Dutch and the Frisian weren't getting along with each other. And it was just a mess. But, you know, then my father wound up serving a church in Paterson, New Jersey, of mostly black folks who had come up in the Great Migration and were living in the New York metropolitan area. And so I'd always had an interest in a lot of different things. But listening to your course has given me a lot of additional language and insight into people and why religion works for people in terms of helping them deal with the trauma of life. Mm. And you know, much to the dismay of, you know, the Christian Reformed Church is a fairly conservative, for a long time it was kind of an insular Dutch immigrant community, fairly rigid doctrinally. But, you know, you begin to notice, because of my story, you know, being in African American churches from other denominations, you know, a variety of doctrines, you begin to watch how things play out. And your course has given me so much insight into how religion works and what it does. Stuff that I, you know, you're just embedded within it. And so the perspective from an academic point of view, both philosophically and now as you're getting into the cognitive science, has just been terrifically helpful for me as I try to piece this stuff out. Now, I was anticipating this conversation, so I was catching up because I'd gotten a few weeks behind. Could you talk a little bit about, when you talk about the meaning crisis, now that you've sort of put that on my radar screen, I begin finding it in Owen Barfield and Viktor Frankl and a whole bunch of other folks. So when you talk about the meaning crisis, what are you talking about? What are some of the symptoms of the meaning crisis that you see?
Okay, so first of all, I want to preface it by saying there's already one discussion that I had with Christopher Mastropietro that's available. The reason I'm saying that is the second one is explicitly on the symptomology of the meaning crisis.
Okay.
So that's coming. So this is more a bit of a foreshadow, but it will be very shortly. I think next Tuesday or Wednesday, the answer to your question will come out in detail when Chris and I talk about it.
Okay.
The first one was on sort of symbols and zombies. And that sort of stuff. So I see a set of problems, or we call them symptoms, and the idea that the meaning crisis is a kind of existential illness is the analogy we're using. And so, and you can see them, you can see ones that are what you might call sort of purely reactive. And then there are some that the there are sets of symptoms that you could call responses. And then there's sets of symptoms you could call reflective responses. That's sort of how we've tried to analyze it. So at the reactive end, I think people are just sort of reacting to it. You've got, of course, you've got issues around suicide. And the weird sort of paradox that sort of overall, like the world at all, suicide is dropping as a lot of people come out of poverty, because of course poverty is a driver of suicide, and I'm not denying that at all. But you see in certain age groups in certain areas, like the United States, it's going up, especially among certain age groups. Child suicide in the United States has doubled recently, which is a really, really frightening thing. And you see young people across the world a rise in suicide. So there are things like that. And what's interesting is some recent work by Tatiana Schnell showing, so the normal picture we have is people fall into clinical depression, and that gives them a sense of meaninglessness, and then that drives them to suicide. But what Schnell is showing is, no, independent of people falling into suicide, just an experience of meaningless unknown can independently drive you into suicidal ideation and behavior. So that is that's a very compelling piece of evidence to pay attention to. There's a sense in which a lack of meaning, independent of any clinical depression, can itself be fatal to human beings. Then, of course, you see things in overlapping with that, the general mental health crisis. You've already talked about that in your series, the rise in anxiety, the rise in depression, things like that. And then sort of related to that are sort of a lot of, these aren't as empirically based as the first two I just mentioned, but there's a lot of sort of cultural critique around sort of the rise of narcissism as, you know, a pathology that's more and more pervasive in the culture. And I take that to constellate with what I'm talking about. Loneliness, the rise of loneliness. More and more people are reporting that. And that goes towards things that I talk a lot about in the series, you know, that the way in which I take the fundamental grammar of the meaning crisis to be a sense that you cannot be well connected to yourself, to other people and the world, and loneliness, and its attendant, you know, similarities to things like alienation and things like that. There's a constellation there. And then overlapping with both of those in an interesting way, and I've talked about this on the series, and I'm especially influenced by the work of my friend and colleague Mark Lewis, is the addiction crisis, the rise of addiction, and especially Mark's, I think, really central work showing that the disease model should be abandoned when we're talking about addiction. We should look at it in terms of this learning model of reciprocal narrowing. And I've sort of argued in his presence that that's sort of the opposite of Plato's anagoge, and therefore you should see it existentially. And he's agreed in person with that. He thought that was a very fair point. And then something that I'm just reading about now, and Chris and I are starting to incorporate it into the next book, which is called The Virtual Exodus. And there's some books written about this. So people leaving the real world for the virtual world. And what's especially telling about that is the features of the virtual world. There's even a book called Reality is Broken that contrasts a preference for the virtual world over the so-called real world. Because, of course, what you have in the virtual world, and what I've argued in the series we've sort of lost, is, well, you have a narrative order, right? There's a narrative story, and you play a pivotal role in this, right? There's a normative order. You level up. You self-transcend, right? There's a nomological order. There's a set of rules, and everything follows the rules. And then you also get the flow state of being deeply immersed and connected. So, you know, the sort of quintessential features of meaning cultivation are deeply present in these virtual worlds, and they're contrastively present. That's the phenomenon I'm pointing to. People are exiting, they're preferring, they're critical of the real world in contrast to the virtual world. And that's very telling, right? It's like they're pointing to something that's lacking, and it's called an exodus because it's a hugely demographic thing. I'm trying to think of some of the other things we talk about. We talk about a lot of what we call neo-Gnosticism, where people are taking sort of meaning systems and they're trying to inflate them and make them stand for or carry the burden of what, you know, full-blown meta-meaning systems like religion, right, used to do. And so you get those inflationary things. And that's now we're moving into sort of more the response. These are people responding. And then I think towards the end, you get reflective responses. There's a lot of people, I've been talking to them, that are engaging in what I call serious play. Rafe Kelly comes to mind, where he's trying to integrate parkour with narrative practice and contemplative practices. Other people who are trying to integrate circling with meditative practices, the secular monastery movement. And so these people are engaging in what I call serious play. They're trying to engage with symbolic practices in order to bring about the kinds of transformations that will afford them a recovery of those lost sense of connection. And then at the end, I put people who are really trying to renew Gnosis in the sense that I've tried to articulate in the series, in which there is a lot of attempt. And I put things like the authentic discourse movement. I went to a circling event not that long ago. I found it to be a very profound experience.
What's a circling event?
So this is part of the authentic discourse. And so the idea here is to try and recover. I don't know if you saw it. I did one discussion with Jordan Hall. And there's another one that's coming out. But this idea of trying to do sort of the opposite of what we're doing now, sort of trapped behind screens, mostly propositional. And what you're trying to do is create a communication. I'll use some religious language here. You know that I always use this language respectfully.
Yes.
I don't use it in a way that's intended to be insulting in any fashion. So it's a way in which you're trying to embed communication into communing with other people,
right,
in which you're trying to connect and couple to them, you know, like in this perspectival and participatory way. And so what you end up creating is you sort of tap into the machinery of distributed cognition, and you get kind of a collective flow state that is centered on facilitating people coming to a deeper self-understanding and perhaps experiencing a kind of self-transcendence. And of course, people get, they often get very, superlative about this experience. I found it very profound. People will often attribute various kinds of metaphysical things. People will even talk about, a we space that's been created, access to deeper or ultimate reality. And so it's often tinged with some religious language, which I found as an academic. So I'm there participating fully and sincerely, but I'm also a participant observer as an academic. And I found that very interesting, because the setup is explicitly secular. I mean, it's not anti-religious, but it's explicitly secular. And you see that, I remember telling Chris Mastropietro when I was talking about the experience, I said it reminded me of, you know, where two or three are gathered in my name,
right,
kind of thing, right? And so, and what Victor Turner talked about, communitas, this sort of collective flow state in which you're accessing a kind of collective intelligence, and it's being brought to bear, not on sort of practical problems, but on sort of existential issues. That's what I mean about cultivating Gnosis in a profound way. And so you see things like the mindfulness revolution itself. So these are more positive responses. The rejuvenation and the intense interest. I'll be speaking at a conference in September on this, on things like Stoicism and Neoplatonism and Gnosticism, right? So there's an attempt to, I see all of these things are well explained in a coherent fashion, both what you might call the negative reactive, the more middling responses, and then these more reflective positive responses. I think you can give them an integrated, unified account by talking about something like the cultures going through a meaning crisis. If you'll allow me two more minutes on this, because I want to, there's a point of clarification. Like, there's a sense, and I talk about this as we get in further videos that you're going to see, because we've already recorded some of these. Like, there's a difference between the meaning crisis and perennial problems of meaning. I think at all times, right, and for reasons I go into, for having to do with, well, some of this stuff you've seen already, you know, issues of parasitic processing, self-deception, but more, people are always perpetually vulnerable to despair, to meaninglessness, to, you know, their own personal meaning crisis. And so I'm not claiming that that's novel. What I'm claiming is that in addition to having these perennial problems, there were perennial ecologies of psychotechnologies with traditions and guides for responding to them. And these historical developments that I've articulated in the series have eroded those institutions, those ecologies for many, many people. So when they encounter a perennial problem, it bites very deeply because they have a kind of worldview misattunement. There is no worldview that legitimates the set of practices, that authorizes them, that vets them, that coordinates them, that guide. And so people scramble autodidactically, right? Or they just suffer from the perennial problems. And that's what I mean by the meaning crisis. It's the intersection of these historical forces undermining the perennial kinds of things, the cultivation of wisdom, to put a broad term on it, that was used to respond to the perennial problems. And that's what I see the meaning crisis as.
Well, I think that's very helpful. You know, watching it from, you know, inside a religious tradition,
sure.
is fascinating. And watching, you know, again, your class has been terrifically helpful in, it's deeply disturbing for a lot of people who have, let's say, lived fully embedded and happily so within, let's say, a conservative religious tradition that's also fairly sectarian. You know, there are always these jokes in the Christian Reformed Church where, you know, they go to heaven and someone says, shh, you know, be quiet around them. Those are the CRC people. They think they're the only ones. They think they're the only ones here. And the Christian Reformed Church is sort of a denomination that's conservative enough to have some of that dynamic, but not quite so conservative that there aren't elements of the denomination that are a little uneasy with that.
And so
happened to many conservative denominations, the Second World War, the advent of radio and then television, higher education, took people out of their religious, their small religious communities, brought them into a bigger world, which began to force people to ask questions about, okay, here in my church, we go through James K. Smith, who's a philosopher at Calvin College, has done a series of books on cultural sure. liturgies. And part of the Kuyperian tradition has been to try to see the world through religious lenses in a bit more open of a way without losing the sense of embeddedness and home. But it's, you know, everything that you talk about, especially given my experience with the Black community, working with Haitians in the Dominican Republic, Dominicans living with Dominicans in the Dominican Republic now in California, Hispanic communities, Tongan communities. Now we have a Nigerian Anglican church that worships in our building on Sunday. You begin to watch a lot of these other communities and then non-Christian communities, Northern California, a lot of people experimenting with all sorts of other,
right.
other types of religion. It's fascinating watching these dynamics. And now as a pastor, you know, taking some of the language and insights that you have in your course and thinking back on, you know, how I grew up, how things worked, watching Black churches, watching Haitians, and saying, oh, this is sort of what's happening psychologically. This is what's happening
sure, sure.
in realms. Now that type of observation people often find disorienting and potentially even secularizing, because which gets into the dynamic of the meaning crisis, where now suddenly, if everything is mechanistic, if I listen to Jonathan Haidt, for example, if going around the central symbol, you know, a centering process, if going around the central symbol coheres us as a community, and I know that, oh, I'm not experiencing the God, but there's a psychological dynamic at work, and I'm experiencing community because of who people are, a circular motion, or this we say together, and all of the practices that we've done in church and liturgies, all these psychotechnologies, even just the word, suddenly people begin to say, oh, well, maybe all of this is bullshit in that sense of the word. I mean, and in many ways, that's at the heart of the meaning crisis. And part of what society has experienced over the last 80 years is, you know, so Dutch immigrants came from the Netherlands to small isolated communities. And even when they were in urban centers, they stuck with their enclave. Yeah, yeah. And then by virtue of urbanization, of education, of a whole variety of factors, now suddenly they're forced to sit mm-hmm. with Baptists and Roman Catholics and immigrants from Muslim immigrants and people from all over the world. They begin to find commonalities. They begin to relate to each other on different levels. And then suddenly all of their narratives of God and religious, all of this narratival embeddedness gets dislocated. Mm-hmm. And well, then, you know, I read Scott Alexander's blog from time to time. He was doing some very interesting, he's a psychiatrist who blogs under a pseudonym, Scott Alexander, Star Slate Codex. He was looking into some very interesting dynamics of rates of mental health and immigration.
Yeah.
How even people leaving their situation and coming to a new land where things are in many cases better materially.
That they suffer domicile to a degree. Yes, for yes. sure. Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, I've really appreciated how your course has brought out these issues, even though in talking to some people about your course, some of that dynamic feels threatening to them. Because in a sense, sure. if you explain something that's felt on the inside, like God, as a psychological dynamic, now suddenly the sure. narrative wonder is broken. And I mean, people can have the same experience taking a literature course and looking yeah. at how literature yeah. does these things. And so, you know, part of what, when I listen to your course and when I listen to it from very much continue to be embedded within a religious tradition, a lot of what I recognize is that the meaning crisis, people don't even have a name for the crisis that's hitting them.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
And the even sometimes the conceptual journey of saying, of explaining, well, this is probably some of the reasons why you're feeling dislocated and, you know, feeling ripped out of your home. One of the things that I've appreciated about your course is that I can very much see, and I think you'll probably get into it as you go further, there's going to have to be a sense in which the meaning crisis will need to be addressed for regular people.
For sure. Yeah.
And now, especially given the fact that, you know, you have experience, and I really appreciate, you know, some of your story here in terms of, you know, grew up in a more fundamentalist church and then spent some time in some more liberal traditions. What are some ways that, and really working, I mean, my sense is that you've been working your way through this meaning crisis yourself.
Yes, very much.
And I mean, we all do this. I mean, people ask me, well, why do I make videos? Well, it kind of with Jordan and the biblical series and all that, I kind of landed this. But what I do on my videos is this is in a sense therapy with a webcam where yeah. I'm talking out my stuff. Where do you see what kinds of institutions, because there's going to have to be institutions, practices, institutions, how do you see this landing for people for whom just the word psychotechnology will likely be threatening?
Okay. so that's a tricky question. So I can tell you what I have been doing, and then I'll try and make it more specific to your question. What I have been doing, I mean, one of the gifts of the series, and I keep saying this, is I've got to meet people who are putting really real time and talent and money into, you know, trying to respond to the meaning crisis, trying to create places. And so, I mentioned Rafe Kelly and the community he's creating, or Daniel Thornton and the Secular Monastery right network, Thomas Bjorklund's work, you know, where he's trying to create retreat center, right, and trying to sort of reconstruct what was happening, in the Nordic countries when they were sort of trying to get themselves out of an agrarian sort of an authoritarian thing. And he has that whole argument. So I'm talking to him, talking to him more, talking to people like Jordan Hall, like I mentioned, or Peter Lindbergh and the whole authentic discourse. And I'm not just talking. I take up a lot of these practices. I try to understand. I resonate with practices I've been pursuing for a very long time. And so part of what I see happening is a couple things. I mean, I'm recommending, I guess, I feel hesitant taking that position, but people are sort of asking me, I'm recommending this, or this idea, right? This idea of an ecology of practices where you try and get various practices. I will make a clear, and there's two videos that like coming where which I do this in great detail and clarity. So I'm just being very gestural here. And I'm asking for patience on behalf of your readers. And so, but the idea is, well, let's get clear. Let's get really clear about these perennial problems. Let's come up with sets of psychotechnologies that would ameliorate them, address them, maybe even alleviate them, right? And then let's create an ecology of them. Like, let's find relationships of complementarity, strengths and weaknesses. And so we set them in sort of a dynamic system that has a capacity for self-correction and for evolution. And then you want to set that within, right? We're starting, I'm working with Daniel Craig to create what we're calling the Virtual Wisdom Institute, which sounds horribly Orwellian. yes. But the idea is, can we create a co-op where we can, you know, coordinate these various communities? So they're vetted and they're cooperative and they're mutually facilitatory. And then the idea is that when they try to create sort of an overarching normativity of practice, they do it in sort of a wiki fashion, like Wikipedia. One of my courses with Konstantinos Xanathos, we've been creating a what we call the Verwiki so it's basically former students get together and they write articles about the arguments. And I've been really impressed by how effective, like really effective, this is as a strategy for collective, tapping into that collective intelligence and creating something that isn't tied to a personal individual and their personal sort of power project. It's right. It's much more collective. It's constantly self-corrective, right? And so the idea is to use the machinery of a wiki to create, and again, I mean this respectfully, and an analog to sort of what creeds used to be, right? That this is our creedal structure, but it's always in service to the religio. It's always in service of how can we create reliable communities and sets of practices for restoring these senses of connection, affording the cultivation of wisdom, affording the deep alleviation of the perennial problems. So that's the project I'm actually currently engaged in. And the series is, directed towards facilitating that. I talk with other people. I mentioned Rafe Kelly. I'm talking with Mike Nan. He runs a martial art dojo, and he wants to incorporate the teaching them the students, like these 14 and 15 year olds, stuff about the history, the meaning crisis, but also the cultivation of wisdom. And so I'm learning a lot about this and what it might feel like and how we might try to do it. So I'm not just talking about this. I'm really trying to, both within my own life but in concert with many other people, trying to do exactly what you're asking. What can we do so that, I believe you called them regular people, what can we do to help them respond to the meaning crisis? So this is very much a project that I'm engaged in. And I see it becoming more and more something I devote more and more of my time to. Now to the difficult question that was at the core of what you asked me, how that would be integrated with, I could see people in your church doing a circling event very much. I could see them taking up a Christian form of meditation, a Christian form of contemplation. I can see, them even doing an appropriate, movement practice, so I could see them, adopting this and sort of finding a way of, symbolically revaluating it or renaming it, under a Christian heritage. I could also see, I'm trying to be really honest with you, that this could be seen as a threat. Like this is, you know, this is a secular, Verveke's building a secular church that's undermining the true church. although that's not my intent, I'm trying to be respectful to your community. I could see that happening. So that's a difficult question. I would hope, so this is only a hope, I would hope that, you know, I Jonathan and I have both been invited, not for this September, but for the following September, to where are we going? We're going to somewhere in Northern Ontario together. And it's about trying to create a dialogue between atheists and theists and using his work and my work to do that. I would hope that I could work with people like Jonathan, people like yourself, to help that bridging. Right. Because, you know, if people within Christianity can find a way to make use of all of this and respond in a way that's authentic, right? And maybe later we could talk about what that might mean and the challenges of that. But if they could do that, I'm all for that. I make it really clear I'm not anti-religious by any means. It's for me personally and for many of the people I've met, and I've got demographics to support this, and you also have cited them. For many people, religion is no longer, in James's sense, it's no longer a viable option for them. Trying to understand why that's the case is one thing, and trying to do that. And then on the other hand, trying to, okay, but we don't just let these people go. What do we do? That's, and I'm trying to respond in that fashion. I hope that's an answer to your question. I'm trying to answer responsibly.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that I often reflect on is how, well, I don't think you can look at the human race and not at some point note how dramatically religious human beings are.
Sure.
You know, you look at almost any of the major constructions of the ancient world and even the medieval world, they're almost all religious in nature. And so I was talking to Sevilla, who runs the Quality Existence channel.
Yeah, and I'm glad you guys met, because she's been talking about my work, and I want to support her work. I think she's doing interesting stuff. I would like to at some point talk to her directly and record it for my audience. Yeah,
I'm sure she'd love to. But so, you know, one of the observations she made, she began in art, and then she was working in the mental health field, and she was working in a clinic basis in which, you know, she began to see that and this has been my experience given my father's work, my own work, and my grandfather's work too in Owen Sound, Ontario, that in many cases, you know, religious communities without, you know, the cognitive science have had practices that have been obviously been meaningful, address trauma.
Yep.
You know, religions have been doing mental health work for a very long time. And one could very much argue that, you know, religions very much grow out of our psychic needs. And so this is where practices develop from below. I have my own audience I have to consider. From below perspective. You know, one of the things that's been happening, and I think it's very helpful to have do conversations like we're doing now, because as a pastor, I see not only is there, say, dislocation of people who are walking away from religious traditions and religious institutions and begin sort of making their own stuff up out there, but there's been tremendous sharing and change, experimentation in religious communities in the West. And you look at, you know, Richard Rohr, who has taken a fair number of Jungian things. He's very popular in sort of a Roman Catholic tradition. There's all kinds of things happening where, and of course, within religious communities, these things are never done without a bit of strife, without some anxiety, sometimes without conflict. But though that strife, anxiety, and conflict is also part of the process, because religious communities also tend to have a self-corrective nature to them. They're often fundamentally conservative, which sometimes means they're not going to go off certain deep ends, although sometimes they do.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it's when I think about something that has to address, let's say, regular people. So as a pastor, you know, sometimes people get confused. I'm not an academic. I'm a pastor. Well, pastors read books. We do. So, but we're always involved in application.
Yeah.
And so I got part of my YouTube journey started with the Freddie and Paul show, where Freddie says, let's do a TV show. And part of what's different between, let's say, a pastor and a therapist is I don't only encounter my clients in this little box. I
live in a community.
I live with them.
Yeah.
Sometimes quite literally. So religion has had this demonstrated power to be highly viral and highly effective. At the same time, and many times that you've made the comment that, and I'd like you to flesh this out a little bit more. And I'm sort of between you and Jonathan on this, because Jonathan, I think sometimes, although I don't know if the Orthodox Church in America is quite as unchanged as, let's say, the Orthodox Church in Greece or Russia or, sure. You know, there's a lot of interesting stuff in there for me just sort of watching that. But Jonathan is in the sense highly conservative in that he's the Orthodox Church. We don't change, you know, they keep their walls. Protestant churches tend to be this messy middle where there's all kinds of things going on, partly because of the institutional flexibility that happens. And so Jonathan, you know, and a lot of people in terms of the conversations I've had, those who have kind of been swept up in the Jordan Peterson phenomenon have shown a very real interest in orthodoxy, which to me makes a world of sense given what's happened in the long work that you've been doing.
Yep.
So when you talk about, you know, and in one of your, when you talk about can't go back to religion, and in one of your last videos that's been released, I really enjoyed that section where you said, we need a religion that isn't a religion. And this is what I see people doing when, okay, I can't go to church anymore, but I'm going to go to yoga on Sunday mornings. This person with the crystals over there, that's kind of interesting.
Woman
with the tuning forks, well, that kind of feels authentic. So
the nuns have not filled the ranks of the new atheists audience. Some have, but most haven't.
Yes.
And
they're leaving quickly. I mean, Jordan kind of triggered an exodus from Sam Harris, and it's been fascinating watching this thing play out.
You've heard me make the argument. I've made it before. There's two Jordans for me. There's the political Jordan, which I have deep disagreements with. For a lot of reasons. And I have a wonderful relationship with the University of Toronto. So, but then there's the Jordan that, and there's some history to this. There's the Jordan that put his finger on the meaning crisis. The first video that wasn't political that went huge for him was the one where he and I were talking about meaning in life, right?
Yes.
And that's not a coincidence. So that, I mean, he's put his finger on that. I think that I try to acknowledge in setting up what I call this hard problem. I think stuff you're pointing to, I said, you know, we're facing what Thomas Bjorklund calls the meta crisis.
Where's his book here? I just want to recommend, he's got a book out there that people should
take a look. Bjorkman, Thomas Bjorkman, The Nordic Secret. That's sort of his response. So Thomas Bjorkman talks about the meta crisis. You've heard me, other people talk about it. And the idea is trying to respond to this is going to need comprehensive transformation in consciousness, cognition, character, community, culture. And the only things that typically have done that in the past that have organized these ecologies of psychotechnologies and set them into, you know, socioeconomic and political systems have been religions. That's the only thing that it's done in the past. And so I take that to be very much in consonant with your thesis that, you know, there's reasons why we've been religious and religion has been doing all of this work for all of this time. And I take that to be behind Nietzsche's, you know, the madman coming into the marketplace, and he's arguing with the atheist, you don't know what you've done in killing God. Like, you don't know what you've done. You don't know what you've done, right? And so I take that to be a very deep point. I take it that we tried, you know, post-Nietzsche, post-Marx, we tried secular alternatives, you know, totalitarian ideologies in which ideology was going to be this comprehensive thing. And I guess that's part of Jordan's critique, right, that those ideologies drench the world in blood. So people are now sort of trapped, right? It looks to them, I think it's an incorrect framing, but it looks to them like the secular and the religious alternatives are both off the table. But as we agree, these perennial problems cannot be left unaddressed. So what they do is they often, as you said, they autodidactically cobble together, you know, sets of psychotechnologies, ritual practices, without sort of seeing the full import of what they're doing, without grounding it in, you know, a deeper ontology. And so there's tremendous risk there. Autodidactism is a terrific way to inflate and emphasize your own self-deceptive.
Can you unpack that a little bit for people who haven't maybe watched your course?
Oh, so the idea about autodidact, so being self-taught, right? So one of the big themes running through the course, right, is the idea that human beings have a lot of machinery that's adaptive, but that machinery also biases us in terrifically powerful ways, and it can in a sense misfire, if you'll allow me that analogy. And so we're prey to a lot of self-deceptive behavior. I give the example in the course of when you take your friends to the airport, right? And you say, oh, you know, you give them all these euphemisms for don't die, you know, don't, you know, have safe trip, text me when you're there, and all this sort of, all this euphemistic stuff, because, right, you can easily imagine a plane falling, because, you know, huge thing in the sky, right? So this is called the availability heuristic. It's easy to imagine that. And so your brain says, oh, I can imagine that easily, so it must be highly probable. And then your brain also, right, can use the representative heuristics. When a plane crashes, it's a superlative member of the category. It's a disaster. It's a tragedy. So because it's so representative that way, people, it must be a highly probable event. So your brain uses these two heuristics and tells you, oh no, oh no, oh no, this person's getting into an airplane. And then you turn and without thinking about it, get into the North American death machine, the automobile, and drive home, right? Because it doesn't trigger those heuristics. Now you say, well, why would we use those heuristics? Well, this is part of what's happening in the second part of this. We use those heuristics because we're always engaged in the problem of trying to zero in on relevant information. We can't explore all the information, so we have to focus our attention. So these heuristics are largely adaptive, but they make us very, very prone to being self-deceptive. That's what I mean when I say that's part of why the perennial problems are perennial. The very machinery that makes you adaptive makes you simultaneously vulnerable to self-deception. So this is a lot of work I do as a psychologist, right? So the problem with autodidactism is you don't get correction from other people. You don't get people challenging you on your biases. And the thing about the thing that's pernicious about social media is it looks like you're getting that correction, but of course you're selecting your audience, and then you're just getting the echo chamber effect, right? And so what happens is, like, let's take another bias, the confirmation bias. We tend to look for evidence that confirms our beliefs and not challenges it. And so if I'm an autodidact, all of these biases, right, I'm going to only look for things, and I'm going to get into, there's a very real risk that this self-deceptive machinery is just going to be accelerated and exacerbated, right, in a very, very, very powerful way. And so that's one of the great risks of doing this in kind of an individualistic, autodidactic fashion. The second risk is that, even if, let's say, you weren't falling prey to some horrible irrationality, you know that I use the word rationality much more broadly. Even if you're not falling into some very self-destructive and other destructive forms of irrationality, the fact that this is autodidactic often means that there's a shallowness to it. It isn't grounded in a deeper worldview, a deeper ontology. And so it doesn't have the kind of resiliency that is needed for a massive, you know, sort of conceptual and practical restructuring when it's needed. If things suddenly shift in the environment, you need to be able to restructure in a powerful way. But if you're an autodidact, there's a risk. I'm not saying a certainty, but there's a genuine risk that it's very shallow. And I see this in my older son's friends, right? The meaning crisis. And then as soon as something happens, they have no resiliency. They collapse. They fall into, you know, kind of very deep and almost traumatic levels of, you know, despair and anguish and anxiety, and so, because they don't have the little meaning system that they've cobbled together. Sorry, that sounds dismissive, but I'm trying to reference its insularity and its shallowness with that term, right? It doesn't give them the resources for the significant self-transformation and restructuring that might be needed to encounter this unexpected, you know, perennial problem, life crisis, cultural shift, etc. And so that, for me, is deeply worrying. So if you put it that way, it sounds like, well, you know, religion's out, secular alternatives are out, and I can't stay as an autodidactic thing. And that's what I take to be the hard problem of the meaning crisis. So, yeah, I'm very much, I think, in agreement with you. Now, the specific question about why people can't go back to religion, I'd like to explore that in detail with you. And I want to say something on Jonathan's behalf here. I'm not trying to override you. Yes, I can see what you're saying. And Jonathan is very conservative, and I think there. I wouldn't call it conflict. We have a fun tension about it. I think it's a lot of the Neoplatonism that's so attractive in the Orthodox Christianity. But I'll let Jonathan and I talk about that at another time. I mean, also what's clearly attractive about his work, and I think this comes a lot out of the Neoplatonism, he's quoting Maximus all the time, right, is the whole unpacking of a symbolic way of life. I think that's very important. But I also would like to point out, because Jonathan has done this specifically in response to my work, so I think it's legitimate for me to bring it up. He thinks that Christianity might itself be going through something, again, I'm trying to use this term respectfully, through a resurrection. Yep. So in that sense, he's radically not conservative. I mean, he's conservative insofar as he's invoking what you might call a traditional idea, but he's invoking it in a radically revolutionary way. He thinks the meaning crisis and Christianity is going through, might actually go through, I take it he means something like a death and rebirth, which is a very fundamental kind of restructuring, I would take it. So I think that there's that element there in his work. I just wanted to point that out because I think that is something that Jonathan has brought up, and I know he's committed to it as a response to my work, and I want to treat it with respect and acknowledgement. So I just wanted to bring that out. I think for many people, why we can't return to religion, I mean, one does not want to be grandiose. Obviously, and you as a pastor know this, there's deeply personal reasons. There's idiosyncratic reasons that have to do with people's personal history, the way they might have been traumatized, abused. I do not want to dismiss that. I just can't address that because those are idiosyncratic stories. That's not my job, right? But when I meet people individually, I take it seriously. One of the many reasons why I try to treat people who are religiously committed with respect is precisely because I don't know their idiosyncratic thing. I make an argument for the indispensability of a lot of symbolic things. We can talk about that perhaps later. But for many people, in addition to those idiosyncratic reasons, I've tried to articulate the collapse of what I call a cultural cognitive grammar. A way of trying to articulate these three sort of orders, a way in which people want to be connected narratively, normatively, nomologically, right? The way we developed this cultural cognitive grammar that articulated, legitimated that, mapped it onto our ontology, and then also mapped it into our psychology. And it did all that terrific work. Yep. And for reasons I tried to articulate very carefully in the series, that has been very, very significantly undermined. And so for many people, right, they feel that a return to religion is not viable for them because they do not see the religion responding to this issue in a deep way. I mean, I know that from talking to people personally and also from just taking a look at, you know, what are people doing when they describe themselves as spiritual rather than religious? And what typically is, well, I want to cultivate wisdom. I want to cultivate self-transcendence. I want all these practices, but I don't buy the worldview. I don't buy the grammar. I don't buy the way people are organized. I don't buy the way in which, you know, the community is set up, etc. And so I think for many people, I've tried to articulate what I would hold as an explanation for why many people find religion non-viable anymore is precisely this long process of, you know, the collapse of the three orders, and that And I mean, you and I would disagree on this, and I respect that, you know, but for many people, they think, they feel that that delegitimizes a lot of the of the religious alternative for them. They are also usually people who find that the blood soaking of the 20th century delegitimizes, you know, the secular pseudo religious alternatives, the totalitarian ideologies, and so they tend to reject both sides pretty even handedly, and so that's why I think the problem, as I've articulated, is a better way of articulating the problem. It's not just that they can't return to religion, they find the secular alternatives also non-viable for many of them.
Yeah. Well, and as a pastor, so, you know, I got into this when, I mean, I was just a pastor minding my own business, and and I, you know, Jordan started making some interesting videos and people started making noises, and I thought, well, maybe someone who knows maybe something else about the Bible could do a little commentary on Jordan's videos, and then suddenly I have a following, and then people are coming to me. And part of what has been, so this has, I've always had a diverse group of people around me to kind of get a sense of, you know, what's going on in the world. But this, of course, has opened up whole new veins. And many of the people that I talk with, and then, you know, wound up having conversations with people on my channel that were sharing, you know, many people like Job from the Netherlands and Jem from the UK do find themselves in the middle.
Yeah.
Where they'll say, you know, I really, so Job in the Netherlands actually has joined his church, even though he told his church, I don't believe in God, but I like coming here and I like being with you all. So we do this, but, and of course, on a large level, these things have been going on for quite a while.
Oh, for sure. For sure. And I mean, I try to articulate that in the series, you know, that there's a sense in which, you know, social media and other things have ramped the meaning crisis up, because they just ramp everything up. I mean, they really do. And they particularly ramp up the self-deceptive machinery, as I've tried to articulate. But the history of this, I mean, I think it goes back to, I think, you know, I think it starts in sort of the 11th century kind of thing. So I think it's got a long history, and that history is also very complex. And trying to understand that, part of the work I do, one of the courses I teach is on thinking, reasoning, and problem solving. And over half, if I have to put a quantitative number on it, of solving a problem is formulating the problem really well. You have to formulate a problem really, really well, or else you're into combinatorial explosion, or you've got ill-definedness and all this stuff. And so that's why trying to articulate this history, I think, is really, really important. And I'm hoping to help. I mean, again, that sounds grandiose, but there's a sincere thing. I want to help people like Job. I want to give him, a deeper understanding of the sort of bind that he's in right now, trying to articulate it much more clearly. And I mean, a lot of the feedback I get, and a lot of it is from people that are religious, or at least, you know, post-religious in a meaningful sense, right? Is that, yeah, that's what it's doing. It's really helping me articulate the situation I'm finding myself in. So I'm hoping, I mean, I try to then, you know, in the second half of the series, like, what would that look like, the religion that's not a religion and things like that. I'm hoping that will also be valuable. Again, I'm interested to see what people like yourself and Jonathan have to say about that endeavor. I'm sure there'll be some very, very useful critique.
Well, and you know, part of, again, so much of the stuff that you've brought forward, I think, has been tremendously helpful for me as a pastor. When you talk about this, you know, this autodidactic process, you talk about that in individuals, and I very much see that in individuals as they throw off religious tradition and they're out there and they're sort of making things up on their own. And there's, you know, other people around them are kind of saying, yeah, they're bullshitting themselves, but they're nice people and they don't seem to be hurting anybody. So, and they're not terribly open to, you know, critique of the little religion they've put together for themselves. But churches have been doing this in a larger scale for a while.
Yes, I was in one.
That's part of the problem. And in a sense, both it's easier for churches to do that on a larger scale because some of the other factors, they have community, they have reinforcement, and then it's just
support.
Individuals who get to a point where they just can't take it anymore, and so then they take on which for many individuals is a tremendously costly thing relationally to break from that community, break from family members, and sometimes the people on both sides don't handle that situation well. But you know, so part of part of my tradition, the little segment of Dutch Calvinism that I have come from, has always at least attempted to let's try not to bullshit ourselves too much about our fundamentalisms, and that requires a very difficult dance of both having a fair amount of security where I can explore questions without losing myself, and especially hard to do in a community that is anxious because people have been peeling off, the numbers have been going down, cohesion that was remembered from before the war has been lost. And so, you know, part of what I hope to do, at least with whatever influence I have, is to, you know, continue to encourage Christians. I'm glad you changed the title of the course, because even though I didn't have a problem with Buddhism and cognitive science, there's a certain group of people who will never listen to a course because it just has a tribal label on it. And that's part of the, I think, the blessing of secularism, is that it does have sometimes the potential of creating a more neutral space where people can come together.
Yes, talk. I agree with that. Yes, very much.
And I think part of what's sort of brought some of this on has been social media. And that before I started making YouTube videos, YouTube was a place where someone who would point me to a video, I would watch a video. But I didn't have any idea that this could be a space that could actually function productively in people's lives for things of this nature. And I still have a fair amount of skepticism, because as a pastor, I'll sometimes have people write to me and say, well, Pastor, you're my pastor and your YouTube channel is my church. I'll say, no. There's that can never be.
But
at the same time, you know, I think, again, one of the blessings of the Jordan Peterson phenomenon was saying, wow, this could be used for something transformative. And as you've said a number of times, my network of conversation partners greatly increased via this medium. And I have probably a sense of what you opened up when you started your YouTube channel, but how do you think social media can be used, and what do you hope your offerings will produce?
Totally, good question. I mean, part of this goes to what Rebel Wisdom, David Fuller, and they're trying to create this new taxonomy, and they put me into one of the classes. So there's the contrast between the intellectual dark web, where I take it they place people like Jordan Peterson, and then what they call the intellectual deep web, where they place people like myself and people like Jordan Hall and others. And what they're trying to articulate, I think, and it's very much a work in progress because it's an emergent phenomenon, right? But they're trying to articulate what this looks like. How can social media, YouTube, this... How, and that's what they mean by the intellectual deep web. Not so much how can it be a place where you can sort of criticize, you know, the conventional norms and blah, 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 right? But no, instead, right, it's vectored more onto the kinds of questions we're discussing here, right? How can we use this well, to use my language, which they sometimes use, so I think that's fair. You know, how can we use this to respond to the meaning crisis? How can we use this to get the kind of rich and complex and dynamic and, you know, evolving conversation going to really, you know, again, one doesn't want to be pretentious, but to really give a powerful way of responding to the meaning. There's no alternative. Like I said, I mean, that's why I keep referring, you know, to Thomas Bjorkman's work. And we're in a sense of urgency, right? Because of, you know, the other sets of crises we're facing. And I'm particular, well, part of my work, and I talk about this in the series, I'll talk about it again. I'm really interested in how the meaning crisis sort of creates a mental fog, how we're trapped in this in-between place that really sort of hamstrings us when we try to turn to the kinds of transformations we need to address the problems we're facing. I mean, there's somebody was telling me the other day that, you know, a piece of I think it's the Antarctic ice, the size of Florida has calved off and is like just astonishing, you know, things you just can't ignore. And believe me, the people, you know, a lot of my students are nodding. They're frustrated,
yes.
Deeply frustrated that we're not addressing these issues. You know, the looming ecological thing, the growing disparity in wealth. You know, you've got this massive increase in productivity in the United States, and it has made almost no impact on most people's real income. Okay. You know, these issues, right? The attendant issues of the loss of the commitment to the political process of democracy, that opponent processing being replaced by this adversarial crush the opponent. And see, and part of what I would like this, right, this to do, that you and I, we have significant differences, but we can, in mutual respect, I even have affection for you, right? Right, that we can try to create, you know, some kind of response, because we are creating an alternative. I dislike, and that's why one of the few people you'll hear me criticize by name is like Sam Harris, right? Because I dislike the model of, you know, I'm rational and what I do is I destroy and demolish this. And the fact that they keep using that grammar and they find it so attractive is, I think, a very, very telling thing, right? I want this, what we're doing, to the intellectual deep web, to present a real alternative to that, where it's like, no, that if we're pitching our attempt to respond to the meaning, I take that as symptomatic and not helpful. This is not going to help people. It's pitching things at the wrong level for addressing the meaning crisis, and it's framing things in the wrong way for addressing the meaning crisis. So I see the potential in social media, and I have to admit, there were people who were skeptical, but I said, no, I'm going to make a long, complex argument. Oh, nobody's going to listen. Well, it turns out that was wrong. A lot of people are listening. A lot of people are listening, and a lot of people are interested, and a lot of people are discussing this. And so I think, and that's not meant to be a compliment to me. That's meant to be a compliment to them. We should stop, you know, underestimating the potential of the people out there. There's a lot of people that will put the time in and will invest the intelligence and the reflective rationality and want to be involved in an open and honest, authentic discourse about this. And so I see this as, you know, this is where I'm sort of planting my flag. This is where I'm taking a stand. This is the alternative I'm trying to exemplify and create. And I, like I say, I see other people doing that in a very extensive manner. And like I said, I'm very happy through the connection that I've made with, you know, through the people I've got to see, and it's like some of the people I've mentioned on Rebel Wisdom, and and future thinkers, the same thing. They're trying to, no, we want to get out of the answers that are being offered by the intellectual dark web. We want a different kind of discourse, and we want it centered on this problem. So I see what we're doing as addressing that and providing and generating a real alternative.
Well, I agree. And I have been you know, when I started making videos, I kind of held my breath. What were people, would people be like in the comment section? You know, every now and then someone will be a troll in there, but for the most part, people have been wonderful. And this world is full of really brilliant people who are, just like you said, are willing to work and to take time and to engage. One of the things I started when my channel took off was a meetup, and I had to unlearn some things because I always open with prayer, and you know, I always do the church thing. And in the meetup, I don't push any of my religion. I answer questions, of course, but the effect on many people has been profound in terms of, here's a space where, not just a space online, which has been dramatic, but also a space where together we meet a couple of times a month. We talk about ideas, and really sort of how what's come out of it is we discuss what's meaningful.
Yes.
Yeah. And people have been excited about helping other groups start in Northern California, and we've been doing that work. And I've been, even as a Calvinist who has a, you know, fairly dour Augustinian perspective on human nature, I've been absolutely delighted at the capacity of people just, you know, again, and I think I have to, you know, thank Jordan Peterson for this, because I never would have thought anybody else would sit there and listen to somebody talk for 2 hours until I saw people do it for him. And then I put it out. I thought, well, nobody will watch. And then people still do it. And I do find this to be a glimmer of hope that that we can talk to each other. And I have deeply appreciated the spirit with which you've conducted yourself with your course, and I have found your course to be very helpful and hospitable as a Christian to grow and to learn and to expand. So I'm deeply grateful that you, because I know as an academic, and I have the same thing as a pastor, there are many reasons to not take time pouring hours into YouTube.
Yeah, no, for sure.
And but at the same time, I've found it to be very helpful.
Well, thank you. Thank you for saying that. I mean, I take seriously the meaning crisis, and I take seriously the way it's sort of creating a kind of mental fog as we try to address the other crises. So I have a sense of urgency. And I mean, I'm not claiming I'm going to be famous the way Jordan is or anything like that, Jordan Peterson, but I mean, the influence I was having at the university was small. And this is a chance of trying to at least have more influence in a beneficial way. And that's what something like YouTube can actually do. And you know, if reaching enough people and it spreads, right, in way, I was with my partner, she and I were in San Diego for a conference, and it was on a beach outside of an, and she came up to me and she said, "Excuse me, are you John Vervaeke?" And my brother, like, he's really interested in you know, he's always talking about relevance realization and awakening from the meaning crisis. And that was just such a, obviously there's some ego stroking there, but that aside, right, there was a sense of, no, this is real. I am reaching people, like it's reaching and it's making a difference. And that's tremendously encouraging and empowering.
Now, how is this, since I have my own dynamics with other pastors, you know, who are watching me do this, how is this playing in a university setting? Are other colleagues looking at this and thinking about this? What kind of chatter? Because, of course, Jordan's experience is quite unique.
Yeah, no, Jordan and fraught, right? I mean,
yes, I don't think either of us would want to be on the status rocket he's ridden. When my channel went from zero, from 15 to 500, I sort of freaked out, because it's like, you know, I have a life, I have a wife, I have a family. I don't want to be that.
Yes, definitely that. I mean, it's particularly difficult for me. I mean, so what was unexpected, although I should have. So it was a failing on my part. The exposure and the anonymity of the exposure, the fact that I don't know who's watching, really triggered my social anxiety. I suffer from it. And so that the first couple months were like deeply draining and exhausting on me because I was dealing with all of that personal psychopathology. So that's definitely an issue. So I already understand what you're talking about deeply. I also don't want to, and this is a matter of principle that I'm not going to give on. I don't want to build a reputation the way Jordan did.
Yeah.
Right. That's very important to me. I mean, Jordan and I, we were colleagues together. We worked well together. We were at conferences together. And like I say, the stuff that where he's talking about meaning and religion and symbolism, there's a lot of insight there, but I don't want to try and build an audience through any kind of political controversy at all. And so that's going to cost me viewership. That's fine because this is a very important principle for me. I don't know how much my colleagues are watching my series. I mean, one of my colleagues has said, but he's just had a kid. I'm going to read it. It's there. I'm going to watch it. But he hasn't watched it. What's interesting is the opposite. When I take ideas that I've been developing that I talk about in the series and I present them sort of academically, I get very powerful and good response. So it's kind of more of an indirect thing. I've been very careful to not go down that pathway. And so I think the powers that be don't sort of have any problem with me right now. So hopefully that'll keep going. But nor should they. I mean, I'm deeply appreciative and grateful for, I take it as a tremendous privilege to be able to teach what I get to teach at the University of Toronto and do the research there and have the colleagues that I have. So that's, that's where I am. That's where I'm at. That's where I stand. And so there hasn't been any sort of major about it. Now, very different with the students. Very different. It's just the students are out there watching it. And often students that I have not yet taught, and they're coming into my courses because they're watching the videos. So I think it's legitimate for me to take that as a success. The fact that the series is bringing people in to the academic setting and wanting to take the more rigorous academic versions of these arguments and these ideas, I take that to be a success of the series.
Well, one of the things, so for years I thought about, I've toyed with doing some book writing for years. I'd blogged for years. But one of the things as a pastor I realized is that the world of people who read books is, not that large. And many of the people of my congregation, they might read a little devotional, but I was doing, especially with men, I was doing Bible studies and book studies with men and just realizing that most of them weren't reading anything.
No, that's for sure.
Part of what got me interested in YouTube was I realized a lot of people will watch or listen. And so I did just as you did. I have an audio only version of the channel as well. And that has really opened up a significant audience. And I think for a lot of people, just like Audible audiobooks have really helped people continue to learn and grow in areas that they're just not going to read a book. And for people putting out books now that there's an author I'll name his name, Nick Walterstorff just put out a memoir. And I wrote him and I said, where's the audio book? And Nick has a beautiful, beautiful voice. I said, Nick, you should read your audio book because that will greatly expand the audience. And not just in terms of driving sales or anything, but just the people who can, participate.
So Chris and I have been taught, Chris Master Pietro and I want to turn the zombie book into an audio book. I want Chris to narrate it because he's got a beautiful speaking voice and he's extremely articulate and quite eloquent. So that's definitely a project that's coming down the road. Again, like you said, it's not for sales. I don't get any money from that book. It's open publishing. But just to, again, make it much more accessible to people. I mean, there's a sense also in which what I tried to do with the series, because it's a continuous unfolding argument, is create something analogous in video and audio form to a book.
Yeah.
And again, there was a risk, but it, so far it seems to have been successful.
Now we've been going on for about an hour and a half, and we've been working down my list. I've got a whole bunch of other things that maybe we can talk about at another time, get into some course content, but I think, I don't know that necessarily goes here. Anything on your list that you wanted to touch on? I mean, I critique your stuff on YouTube. I mean, you can have at it on some of mine. That's fine.
Well, I don't have anything that comes to mind. I mean, I mean, I'm going to be talking with him on Saturday. JP was offering, panpsychism as a response, and I mean, I have some deep responses there. So maybe after I talk to him, you and I could talk again about that, because I mean, he presented his ideas to your audience. I'd like to talk to him so I get a dialogue going, get a good understanding, and then I have responses to some of the things, reasons why I don't think. There's a reason why I think certain versions of panpsychism are not not viable, and also not viable solutions to the meaning crisis. Those are two different things. So I would like to talk about that at some future point. I'd be interested in talking to you as I get. I mean, you saw an older, and I'm very critical of it, version of, you know, an argument for a retaking on sacredness and what that looks like. And I've got, I think, a much better version of it now. And I'd be interested down the road of hearing both, like, on your own, but also perhaps potentially in another conversation, what you think about that and how you respond to that. Because that is where, again, respectfully, I'm criticizing sort of supernaturalism as a way of understanding the sacred. You've already heard this, I'm criticizing the idea of belief as the primary vehicle by which connectedness and meaning are made. So at some point, I'd like to have, you know, an open and frank discussion with you about some of those issues that I think we are at a place where we can talk about them, even though they're in some sense contentious. I think we can talk about them fruitfully in a very cooperative and I think, you know, mutually respectful fashion. And I would very much like to do that at some point. Because, like I said, I respect what you're doing. And how do I put this? I'm open to Jonathan's proposal, that we might see Christianity do some massive resurrection and restructuring and retooling of itself. I'm not convinced by that either. Yeah. And I'd like to talk about something like that also with you at some point. I mean, I'm not trying to ruin you into another conversation, but you're...
No, I'd love to have another conversation, John. That's I'm very much down for it. Natural, supernatural, this obviously is a category that comes around fairly late in
yes.
history.
And I take pains to show that in the series. Yes, yeah. Very much.
And also, you know, as I did in one of my videos, clergy have for a long time known the difference. So you have a church, you have a church filled with people that you preach to every week, and you have all of this, you know, really high language about we're opening up the Word of God and the preacher is preaching the Word of God. And as a preacher, you might deal with someone who has been listening to this for 30 years you think, what am I doing? And they'll say, this is what I believe in. This is how they act. And, you know, this goes all the way back to the Apostle Paul in Romans 7, the good that I would do, I don't do, and the evil that this is so human of us. And so I think these are all good conversation to have. And one of the issues, so, you know, at some point, I'd love to have a conversation with you about Luther. I just finished.
Yes, yes.
This book, Fatal Discord, which Ron Dart, who teaches in Fraser Valley, recommended to me. And, so when I listen to Jonathan and I hear his ideas of resurrection, that's very attractive. But when I look at, I want to do some videos on this, you know, what happened, you know, to what degree it was Luther and to what degree it was the moment. I mean, what happened there in the Protestant Reformation?
You did a
conversation with I think it was Kurt, and you mentioned the Protestant Reformation, and he said, well, you know, what is that? And I thought, they are the Protestant Reformation is this titanic event.
Yeah, it should be called the Protestant Revolution.
Yes, and it's almost not even taught in schools today. And I think, but you know, I think a lot of the language that you've given in your course has really helped me to think about, okay, what is with this transition from this sacramental system? Then with Luther, it becomes, faith becomes almost this psychological entity, which, you know, and obviously all kinds of the political, the religious, the social, the economic, all of, by the time Luther hits, and especially in the area of North Germany, all of that just kind of whoosh. I mean, the thing just collapses and transforms the world, you know. And I think what's particularly good about that book is I haven't read another book that so helpfully illuminates the, we're living in a time now where we can see rapid, you know, I share your reticence about getting too close to anything political, but, you know, obviously in the United States, the election of Trump or the passing of Brexit, these are transitions that happen. And it's like a transition like this says, okay, certainly he's an interesting individual, but this
is something else is going on. Yes, yes,
that's right. A lot is going on. So, you know, one day one of the persons at my meetup said to me, he said, "What happens when we have more people in your church for a meetup than we do for your worship service?" And I thought,
that's a really good question.
That's a really good question. but that, you know, but the all my video experience, the conversations I'm having, the meetups I'm doing, I see this very much in continuity with my work as a pastor in even a fairly traditional, fairly conservative denomination. And it not just in terms of, you know, hoping and encouraging and facilitating individuals from the meetup who would like to, many of them are actually pursuing the Orthodox Church, which again, I understand from the shakeout of this, but Christianity over its, Augustine, for example, I remember, I noticed this when I was reading a biography of Augustine and his conversion, and I thought, this is nothing like the 20th century, the reasons people are embracing Christianity.
Yeah. I articulated something similar to that when I was talking about Augustine. Yeah.
Yeah. And so Christianity has morphed multiple times, and it's doing that all over the world. Now, the Christianity that is growing in China, you know, obviously bears traditional continuity with historic Christianity, but will also be different. Same thing in sub-Saharan Africa. And this has happened again and again and again. So you always have the label definition problem of, well, my little Christianity and the Christian Reformed Church compared to everything going. So, you know, I'm actually going to talk with Jonathan again next week, and perhaps we'll get into this, because Christianity will change and elements of Christianity will stay the same. I don't even know that we have words to actually adequately talk about that, even in the Protestant Reformation, which has been written about nearly constantly for the last 500 years. So we're very small creatures riding on much larger waves, much of which we have very little control over.
Well, I would agree with that very, very much so. At some point, I'd also like to talk about the connections I see between the cognitive science and the spirituality, the relevance realization stuff, some of the stuff that it's coming in the series, and your viewers might have seen when I was talking to Jonathan about it, because that's also where, it's also where I find a kind of, I hope, rationally based hope that there's a way of understanding human meaning, cultivation, and the experience of the sacred, self-transcendence, higher states of consciousness, that can be integrated into a scientific worldview and legitimated that way. But nevertheless, I feel, give due respect to the existential and spiritual depth people typically associate with these ideas. And so that's the project I've been trying to do. And I'd like to talk to you about it because I sense that so I'm surmising that you would have a kind of a deep but rich kind of ambivalence about it, because I think you might find the vocabulary, as you've articulated, very, very helpful, but you'll probably also be thinking in your mind about how this might be threatening to people, as you've also articulated. And so it would be good, rather than leaving that sort of on the back burner undiscussed, to discuss it openly and frankly in kind of a cooperative spirit. And I'm of course willing to hear critique and probably vice versa. And so I would like to do that at some point too.
Okay. Well, that sounds good. Well, let's swap some emails and set up some dates and we'll, we can have at that. So any last things? Of course, you've got Awakening from the Meaning Crisis. You've got your zombie book. Any things you'd like people to know that are coming down the line to look for?
In addition to the meaning, Awakening from the Meaning Crisis, there's a couple of supplementary videos. One already come out where I'm doing a discussion with Christopher Massapietro on the semiosis of symbols and the zombie symbol in particular. And then there's one coming out next week. So in addition to the video that's coming out for the Awakening from the Meaning Crisis, there's a video coming out when we're talking explicitly, and I went over sort of it quickly with you, the symptomology of the meaning crisis and trying to articulate that in a more careful and systematic fashion. So that's there. And then down the road, like I said, the two books are coming. Unsheltered, that's the follow-up book to the zombie book with Chris. And then there's the book on the cognitive continuum that I'm doing with Daniel Craig and with Madeline Abramian. So that's also coming down. Those should also come out this year.
Terrific. Well, stay on the line. I'm going to end the video, but I want to say thank you, John, for taking your time. This has been a treat.
Oh, thank you very much. I really enjoyed this, and I look forward to more of these discussions.
Okay, wonderful. And...